What are you doing now?
Rodeo bulls. All systems are go. Bucking bulls. All right.
What do you want, 20?
Yeah.
One more.
Did it right-handed, too. The Senate Public Safety Budget Division meeting will come to order. Today is Wednesday, March 12th, and this is our plan for the meeting. Chris Turner, who was our Senate fiscal analyst, will give us an overview of the governor's budget, and then we'll open up items for public testimony and discussion. And then after we are done with that, we will hear House File 3000, that's Senator Gimsey's bill, correcting something in the statewide public safety radio financing. It's a technical correction. So I think we'll turn it over to Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Members. There are 9 provisions in the governor's supplemental budget that are under the jurisdiction of this division. 2 in corrections, 5 in public safety, 1 in human rights, and 1 in the post board. I would like to note all the reductions. We have 7 reductions and 2 new appropriations. All the reductions carry out in the 2010-2011 tails. These aren't one-time reductions. In corrections, the first provision is a reduction of $2.5 million in fiscal year 2009 in short-term offender grants. This eliminates the $2.5 million appropriated by the legislature last year and reduces the daily reimbursement to the counties for short-term offenders from $33 back to $9, where it was at before session last year. The second corrections provision is a reduction of $600,000 in fiscal year 2009 to the sentencing to service funding. This eliminates the $600,000 appropriated last year by the legislature. Crews cost approximately $100,000 a year. This would eliminate 6 crews. Moving on to the Department of Public Safety, first we have an appropriation, $340,000 for the state match of federal disaster assistance in response to the 2006 Red River Valley floods. We had a deficiency appropriation last year for this, but additional state funds are required to meet match obligations that have been incurred since then. Then we have a reduction of $650,000 in fiscal year 09 for crime victim services. The 2007 legislature increased crime victim services by $1.7 million each year. This proposal would reduce that increase in fiscal year 2009 to a little over $1 million. The appropriation last year was bundled and was allocated 59% to battered women shelters, 17% for domestic violence programs, 11% for sexual assault programs, and 5% for abused children programs. And it's assumed, or at least I'm assuming, that the cut would be similarly apportioned. In addition, it should be noted this proposal will cut the fiscal year 2010-2011 tails for the increase from $737,000 to $84,000. Last year, we we couldn't carry over the entire $3.4 million in tails. We only carried over $1.4 million. So this reduction will severely affect the tails for crime victim services. Third public safety provision is a reduction of $608,000 for CrimNet. The 2007 legislature appropriated $2.4 million in fiscal year 09 for 6 CrimNet initiatives. This proposal would defer some of those projects. I'm not sure which ones. Perhaps we'll find out later in the hearing. The next provision is a reduction of $450,000 in fiscal year 09 for the Financial Crimes Task Force. In 2005, the legislature appropriated $750,000 each year for the task force. This proposal would reduce the appropriation starting in 09 to $300,000, which was the governor's original proposal in 2005. And finally, in DPS, there's a reduction of $40,000 in fiscal year 09 in CAT hazmat team reimbursements. This proposal will reduce the general fund appropriation used to reimburse local chemical assessment and hazmat teams when they respond to incidents. Local teams would still be reimbursed, but the funding would come from billing the companies responsible for the incidents. Continue on to the Human Rights Department. Have a $149,000 reduction of the department's operating budget. This is approximately 4% of their budget. The reduction would be realized through voluntary staff departures, retirements, and, if necessary, layoffs. And finally, we have a peace officer standards and training provision, a $50,000 special revenue appropriation for the post board training reimbursements in fiscal year 09. This was actually part of the 2007 crime bill, but due to a spreadsheet error, the total for 2009 did not include the reimbursement increase. And this has a general fund revenue adjustment to offset the increase in special revenue appropriations, so it is a cost to this division. And that's it. I hope that was useful.
Thanks, Mr. Turner. Do our divisions, our departments all have an across-the-board decrease in funding as well, like many of the other departments do?
Madam Chair, no.
I don't. Okay. All right. Questions for Mr. Turner on what we've heard so far? Okay. We have several people who have asked to testify on various parts of the governor's proposed budget changes, and the first would be Sheriff Borchert from Olmsted County. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. Steve Borchert, Sheriff of Olmsted County, and today speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association as the chair of their legislative committee, and it looks like on behalf of AMC also.
Okay.
The provision that would cut the increase in the 2007 crime bill to short-term offenders is very important and near and dear to us. As you probably remember, and I'm guessing I'm not giving you any new information, but I have to get up here and say this. We have to make our opinion known on this thing. When short-term offenders began, we were looking at a much bigger reimbursement than we ever got, and we ended up that first year about $13 a day per short-term offender that resided in our jail that wouldn't have otherwise resided in our jail for that period of time. That declined from that point forward over the next 3 years. I think my low point was 2006. We got $9 a day. Now we were slated to go up to $33 a day in the deal that was made for the 2007 crime bill. If that goes away, we'll be back at $9 a day. The cost that we sheriffs charge each other, tends to be between $50 and $60 a day. That's not accurate cost. The cost for us to lock people up is considerably more than that. And for counties that have built new jails and still have bond debt service on their bonds, it can be north of $100 a day. So this represents a significant cost shift to the locals to hold these folks that have less than 6 months in the jail. Now, I will say, on behalf of the DOC, they've done a good job on the medical side. They've been good partners in this process so that when we had extenuating medical circumstances and expenses, they've stepped in to mitigate the situation. But the daily cost of incarcerating these folks that would have otherwise been the property of the Commissioner of Corrections has been significant to counties, and we'd like not to see this go away. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sheriff, you have an idea what total this is going to be for the whole state at all? I mean, do you have any figures?
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I confess I did not come equipped with a bunch of data today. It's been a several million dollar shortfall for us in Olmsted County, and I know that with your background, you can extrapolate that to the significance of the cut statewide.
Thank you.
I wish I had the numbers. If you want them, I'll get them for you.
No, that's fine.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Sheriff, what are some of the counties that you're saying are up to close to $100 a day? What kind of counties are we talking about? Metro counties or your county? Or?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, my county, when you figure in the debt service, and you figure in all the expenses, it's a little bit of a moving target. It is something that the DOC is taking up right now, as they were charged to do last year, is to come up with a consistent standardized cost per diem per day. I just got an email on that yesterday, as a matter of fact. And if we can get all the counties adding up the same exact numbers relative to direct and indirect overhead, we should be able to arrive at that number. But it's kind of a floating number now based on the different accounting methods applied by different counties.
Other questions? I have a question. Are most of the are you mostly full? Is your bed space mostly full?
Madam Chair, in my situation, yes. We've exhausted our size, and we are, as a matter of fact, right now kicking off our next 15 to 20-year plan to expand capacity. We have some surplus beds in southeastern Minnesota, but it's a fluid situation. Goodhue has some surplus beds. Steele has some surplus beds. And Moore County is committed to build. We expect surplus beds will come online there in the next couple, maybe 3 years. But it's a fluid situation. And it's not not necessarily a resource that you can count on. It's fraught with all kinds of difficulties relative to scheduling transportation. And when you take inmates out of your own county, you have to make sure that you don't need to go get them the next day and come back to court. So there's a lot of scheduling issues. And who has free space when is a constant juggling act.
Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Sheriff, how many federal prisoners do you have in your jail, and how much are you paying per day or getting paid per day?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, I don't have any to speak of. I have one or two in a transitional way. I'm not renting beds on a regular basis. When we first built our facility in 1993, we rented beds to the U.S. Marshals Service to the tune of 20 to 25 beds that were surplus for us at the time, and we were being paid $75 a day for those beds at that time. I have not been able to rent beds to the U.S. Marshals Service on a consistent basis since about 1996. I am not familiar with what the daily per diem from the U.S. Marshal Service is for those sheriffs that are able to rent beds at this time.
Senator Foley? Assume that this is just whether you have the vacant bed, or does you or other sheriffs contract with the U.S. Marshal Service, and are they the only ones on the federal side that we're dealing with?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, to my knowledge, to take the last question first, to my knowledge, they are the ones on the federal side we're dealing with. Number two, there is a contract. We haven't been involved in it in some time because it hasn't even been an option for us because we've had so much domestic population for the last 10 years. I do know that back in the 90s, there was a split program that you could take grant money to help build your facility, and then you would take a reduced per diem if you took federal inmates at that point. If you did not take the grant money to help build, then you could charge a little higher per diem. But I can't tell you exactly how those numbers have worked out this many years later.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I missed out, Madam Chair, but curious to know what the numbers of people are in that are due to short-term incarceration. Who would cover that? When we transferred those short-termers to the counties, how many of those are currently in service or in use or whatever?
Is Mr. Carlson here from the counties? He wanders in and out. Somebody's here from the counties.
Mr. Murs might be able.
Yeah, okay. Hello. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ken Murs. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Corrections. And I'm sorry, Mr. Foley, I couldn't hear your question.
Madam Chair and Mr. Murs, I'm concerned as to the numbers of short-term offenders that have come over from the state or would have gone to the state if you hadn't transferred.
Yeah, I don't have the numbers for today, but I can give you some numbers. In fiscal year 04, there were approximately 233 offenders per day that were classified as short-term offenders and in local facilities. In fiscal year 07, that number grew to an average daily population of about 356. And if I were to take a guess on today, I'd say it might be just a little bit higher than that today.
Thank you.
Anything else, Senator Foley?
No.
As we work through this, I'm sure there'll be lots of questions.
Where are you going to get the money, I guess?
Yeah, that's a good question, isn't it? Anything else on short-term offenders? Anybody else in the room who wants to talk about the effect of the proposed cut on
to the short-term offender program? Okay, we'll move on to the next one. Sentence to serve. Anybody here want to speak about the cuts to sentence to serve? Anybody from DLC want to talk to us about that? Welcome back.
Thank you. Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Harley Nelson, Deputy Commissioner of Community Services for the Department of Corrections. About a decade ago, about 10 years ago, the revenue funds, the dedicated revenue funds for sentence to service had grown to a certain amount that was so high that the legislative auditor suggested that we spend that down using it for STS. We started five crews and had a contract with Hennepin County as a joint kind of powers venture, and those were used. We utilized the revenue fund that was there. That revenue fund over time got depleted, and so last year, in order to keep those crews going, we came in with our biennial budget and requested the $600,000 to keep that going. That's the money that we need to continue those crews. So there's about five crews throughout Minnesota, rural parts of rural Minnesota, and the contract with Hennepin County would have to end. It hurts deeply, but you look for places that you have to cut, and this is an area that's not going to be crucial to managing case loads and so forth. It is one of the most popular programs for public relations in the community. It's very good for the offenders that are working on those crews as far as cleanup of floods and doing other things that are very positive. So it's not something that we're happy about losing, but when times are tough and there has to be cuts, this was one of the areas that got chosen.
Assistant Commissioner Nelson, are there full-time employees who manage these crews, and would they then be laid off? So are we talking about losing employees as well as the crew, the funding for the actually running the crews?
Yes, Madam Chair, committee members, there are crew leaders that work with these offenders that would end up being laid off. We will look for wherever we can as far as vacancies and so forth and try to accommodate them, but that there would be some layoffs as a result of this.
Can you tell me about how many people that would be?
The Hennepin County one, I think, has about two or three crews there, and there's five other crews, so you're looking at six to eight people. Again, we would attempt at all efforts to try to find other vacant spaces for them and offer them other jobs if their vacancies occur.
Okay.
And we'd be putting them on notice now so that they'd have time to take and go for other jobs if they're available.
All right. Thank you. Anything else on anybody else wants to speak on sentence to serve? Okay. Thank you. Just going down the list, CRIMNET. Who do we have here to talk about CRIMNET? CRIMNET folks aren't here?
I don't know. I know they're in the building.
Yeah.
Oh, there he is. Superintendent O'Malley, welcome back.
Madam Chair, Tim O'Malley. I'm the superintendent at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. The CRIMNET cuts total $608,000, and it would affect two programs at the BCA in the CRIMNET program office. One is the Identity Access Management Project, which is a project in which it's the most frequently requested service for us to move forward by law enforcement and other practitioners in criminal justice. And what it does is it results in a single sign-on, so that when users of the systems could sign on with one password, there'd be one expiration date, and the different databases that are available, they would be able to sign on and get to several of those databases in one fell swoop and have a single page to look at. The result of this would be delaying that. We had plans to, for example, the Predatory Offender Registration Program and that database, and the Minnesota Repository of Arrest Photos, that database, to give it as a practical example. A law enforcement officer in the squad or a probation officer in their office or anybody else in the criminal justice system that has access to those databases now has to sign on two times, have two passwords, have two expiration dates. Instead, they could sign on once, and depending on where they're at, their role in the criminal justice system, they would have access to the level that data practices allows with that single sign-on. Ultimately, this will come about. But the plan was to start integrating that this year. And instead of doing that, we would have to delay that process.
Senator Foley?
Yeah, Madam Chair, the Commissioner, I guess I'm curious to know how, when you're reducing the number of passwords, how secure is that? Why were there two in the first place, and why are you advocating one?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it would increase security, because as police officers, for example, if they have to have six different passwords, and they change at different times, 30 days, whatever it might be, odds are, we know from practice, that they're probably writing those passwords down somewhere, and maybe having them in a squad car above the visor. They might have four or five post-it notes with their that's not a secure way to do business. It would be better if they had a single password, and when they signed on, we knew who was signing on, which we know, and then they'd have access to the different databases in a more efficient way. For one thing, they wouldn't have to sign on several times. It would go much faster. And then secondly, it would be more secure because they'd only have, you know, we all have all these numbers to remember and passwords to remember. The fewer of them practice has shown us, the safer it is in terms of security.
Madam Chair.
Senator.
It just seems that's not a direction you ought to go. I realize that I'm like everyone else, is write those passwords down. But the fact is that you don't gain security by reducing the number of passwords. So why do you think that's more secure?
Superintendent?
Madam Chair and Senator Foley, other members of the committee, they're still going to have the same level of access to any of the databases, whether they sign on eight times to get to eight databases or sign on one time to get to eight databases. And by having only one password, now granted, if they lose that password, somebody then has access to more things. But by having only one password, it's only one thing they have to remember. I think the odds are that it would end up being ultimately more secure, because the odds of them writing it down somewhere where somebody might find it or might use it would be diminished, is the way the theory goes.
Yeah. Interesting.
I used to try to keep them all in my head. It's not working. Superintendent, you said you had two programs that were going to be reduced. Would you talk about the other one then, please?
Yes, Madam Chair. The second program, and this is the Rapid Identification Technology Program. And what this is the live scans are out there in the jails. I think we're all familiar with those and how those have increased efficiency in getting the data back and forth instantly rather than mailing in. This is the next phase, if you will, of those. These are not the live scan units that go for arrest full fingerprints. These are the slap prints or the two-finger ID devices that are in some squad cars now. So it's not a full fingerprint running. They're much less expensive than the live scan, but they're very helpful in terms of processing people through the system. For example, in squad cars now, there are some that have the rapid ID devices. Excuse me. So when an officer makes an arrest on the street, they could put these two fingers into the device, and that person will then be identified to a certainty rather than by name and date of birth. Then as they're driving to the jail, when they get to the jail, that information will have already been transmitted to the jail. The jailer will be ready with all the information. They can populate the screen. When they come in, the officer moves through much quickly and gets back out on the street rather than answering the same questions over and over and over. The plan is to put some of those devices in some of the workhouses and other holding facilities with probation officers and in the courts. And this is a step in the direction of where we're certain we're ultimately going to go, and that's to have this whole system run on biometrics. Name and date of birth, you know, they're just, in a way, random. Anybody can say who they are and whatever date of birth, but your fingerprints aren't going to change. So the goal is to have a number of checkpoints throughout the system so that when somebody goes into court, they put those down and we're certain who we're dealing with. The other advantage is that there are often cases where someone is arrested but not booked into a jail, so we don't have their prints. And then they voluntarily put out a warrant for, they voluntarily show up at court. Well, we'd like to have one of these devices in there so we can be certain who it is that's there. And then it might be that they were arrested years ago. We can populate the screen. We can do all that again very efficiently rather than send them over to the jail. again, this is a direction I think ultimately criminal justice system is going to go, but this would delay this probably by a year, depending on what happens next session.
Superintendent O'Malley, I mean, I don't know how expensive these two projects are to actually fully implement, but it doesn't look like the $608,000 to me would fully implement either or both of those. Am I correct in that thinking?
You are correct, Madam Chair. The first one, the Identity Access Management Project, had budgeted $700,000, and that's a $380,000 cut from that. So it's a little over a 50% cut. So we would still combine a couple of the databases for the single sign-on, but there's probably, as I said, 8 or 10 databases ultimately that we would do. So it would just delay rolling a few of those others out. And then the Rapid ID technology, that is not a staffing issue. That really is just the devices and the software that go with those devices. So that is the $228,000 remaining. That's the cost of the devices that were going to be rolled out.
And the $280,000 would roll them out everywhere you need them to be?
No, I'm sorry, I might have misspoke. The $228,000 for the Rapid ID, that's the cost of those devices, the slap print devices that we're going to go out. So those won't go out at all. We won't buy those. We won't buy the software. The $380,000 is the money that was going to be dedicated to the identity access or the single sign-on. That was out of $700,000, so it's reducing that. There'll be $320,000 left. So we will still move that project forward, but we won't be able. Some of the implementation will have to be delayed until we get enough money to do it, and that is a staffing issue.
Superintendent O'Malley, why is it so expensive to combine the passwords and that whole project, the identity access management project? Do you not have programmers on staff that can just do this as part of a job, as part of their existing duties?
Madam Chair, I'll try to answer it very broadly, and we have others here that if you want a more technical explanation, I'm sure I can't do that. We do have staff on hand, employees, state employees, who can do a number of these services, but we have, I think, 66 projects going right now in the CJIS CRIMNET arena. And this is just one of them, so it's a matter of time. Secondly, we use consultants, and they do get paid more, but we use consultants because some of this is cutting-edge technology, and the idea is to build something that we don't have to fix again in a year. And the hard truth is that the marketplace, it's very competitive for those kinds of services now. So we do have some people come in for some of the newer projects, especially to work on those so that we can combine this efficiently and do it with state. And then it'll last for a long time, and those consultants come and go.
Okay, thank you. Senator Fogle?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. What I want to do is alert you that the Judiciary Committee is going to have to look at all that data privacy thing, and I know there's some studies underway, but before we invest any significant amount of money in there, I want to make certain that the process is up and running and it's working.
Okay.
Having looked at that and watching as we develop these systems more, the more risk that we are to have data that's accessible to the wrong people.
Any other questions for Superintendent O'Malley? Are you going to talk to us about the Financial Crimes Task Force, or would that be someone else?
I think that would be someone else, Madam Chair.
Okay. Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The next item would be the Financial Crimes Task Force. Welcome back, Ms. Ellison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Ellison. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. The cut to the Financial Crimes Task Force is $450,000, which leaves the task force was $300,000 beginning in fiscal year 2009. There is, no doubt that will be a significant impact to this operation. However, what we found during the operation of the Financial Crimes Task Force is that it has been difficult to get local units of government to participate in this effort. excuse me, for a variety of reasons. It just is difficult for people to commit resources when the impact to the local community isn't as great as in some of the other areas, in the violent crime and drugs and narcotics areas, as an example. And so while this is a significant cut, it still will allow for a commander and some local participation. We're also, frankly, looking at financial crimes issues as a state and looking at whether we should have a broader, more statewide effort to address financial crimes in Minnesota. I don't know if this committee remembers, but a few years ago, a fraud unit was created at the Department of Commerce, and they're targeting some insurance fraud areas, and so there are some conversations going on about whether this would be a good time to look at the two efforts and look at what we're doing as a state and whether there's a way to combine efforts and do a more collaborative approach to financial crimes in Minnesota.
Deputy Commissioner Ellison, would this cut mean layoffs at the task force?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't think that that would be the case, and I'm getting confirmation that that answer is correct.
Okay.
Basically, what it amounts to is less money going out to reimburse local units of government for participation in the Financial Crimes Task Force. And as I mentioned, we've had difficulty getting local units of government to participate in this effort.
I know they have really difficult... they must feel like detectives and sleuths and, you know, digging into all of those really complicated transactions must be quite the job. It would be really interesting. I'm not sure I'd be up to it, but it would be really fascinating. Just knowing some of the mortgage fraud that's been going on in my district, it gives me a new appreciation for people who can dig into those kinds of things. Senator Foley, did you have a question?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I guess at some time previous, I heard some discussion about oversight of the financial task force. What is the structure, management, and so forth in the this unit?
Senator Foley?
Yes.
Could you speak into the microphone? I'm having a terrible time trying to hear you today. That one.
In any event, why I'm curious to know what the structure is as far as to who does what and when, and include something dealing with the financial aspect that we forward. Who determines where it goes and where does it go, and those things.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, there is an oversight committee that was created in statute to oversee the operations of the Financial Crimes Task Force. The Department of Public Safety administers the grant programs on behalf of the task force and also administers a grant to run the actual command structure of the task force. And so there's an oversight council, then there's also financial monitoring of the task force activities by the Department of Public Safety.
Okay. Senator Foley?
In addition to that, the financial task force deals with what formerly was the drug task force also?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, no, it's a separate operation from the drug and crime task forces. It's similarly structured in terms of its organizational structure, but it's a different activity. The Oversight Council for the Crime and Drug Task Forces is separate.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for Commissioner Ellison? Thank you very much. The next item on the list is the 4% cut to the Department of Human Rights. I see Assistant Commissioner Kirkpatrick. That is you back there. Would you come and talk to us a little bit about that? Welcome back to our committee.
Chairman DeTor, James Kirkpatrick, Deputy Commissioner. 4% cut essentially would be absorbed either by retirements voluntary departures, voluntary unpaid leave, and last but not least, layoffs. We're projecting 2 to 2.5 FTEs as the effect for the amount.
You really don't have a lot of fat in your budget, do you?
Madam Chairman, not anymore.
Do I remember that we were on our way of getting you a new computer system?
Madam Chairman, that is correct. We hope to have an MFR on the street, I'd say the middle of April. We're currently going through all of our processes to make sure we get it right the first time.
Will that be something that can enable you to work with fewer staff but more effectively?
Madam Chairman, that's the intent. We do a lot of manual processes that will go away and which will allow us to move our resources around to be more effective.
Okay. Any questions, Senator Foley?
Madam Chair, Ms. Kirkpatrick, what kind of help do you get from the locals? It seems to me that a number of local units of government had some form of human rights councils that functioned outside of the state, and they did their own work, if you will. Does that still go on, or is that no longer?
Madam Chair, Senator, currently we have a working agreement with the EEOC, which is at the federal level, which works well. As a matter of fact, it provides funds to the state to the tune of about $300,000 per year. We also work closely with both the St. Paul and the Minneapolis offices, and currently we have an initiative to open up a branch office in the St. Cloud area.
That's a new initiative. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes, it is.
I know that they've had a lot of problems in St. Cloud and the St. Cloud area in the last while. Did you consider not opening that office as a 4% cut instead?
Madam Chair, local jurisdictions are working together to use local funds to assist us in funding that office.
Oh, okay. Good. Any other questions for the Department of Human Rights?
Madam Chair, I would only speak to helping this unit out as best we can. It's a wonderful operation, and the people there are doing a good job, and I'm just grateful for the work that you're doing, and I wish I could give you more money, but obviously we don't have that.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, thank you.
The next area that received cuts is the crime victim services, and I know we've got some folks here who work in that area. Would people who want to talk to us about the effects of the cuts to the crime victim services come to the table? Ms. Ferrucci, Donna Dunn from Minkasa, and the nice woman that I met from Olmsted County, come on up. Anybody else who is interested in talking to us about this? Whoever would like to start, just jump right in.
Go ahead.
Okay, Madam Chair and members.
Pull that microphone right up close to you, please.
My name is Carla Ferrucci. I'm the Director of Public Policy and Prevention at the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. And I want to thank you for allowing me to make a few comments regarding the governor's budget. We know that in the coming weeks, you'll be making some tough decisions about funding for public safety, and I appreciate the time to talk to you about the importance of supporting victim services. I want to start by thanking you for the work you do to support victims in the state. Minnesota's crime victim service programs had gone 10 years without a state funding increase. So the increase made available to programs was deeply appreciated and extremely important in the role that they play in helping, in my case, those affected by domestic violence. I know that this committee has heard devastating stories about the impact of domestic violence, and the reality is domestic violence is a significant problem in our state. Last year, I came before this committee with Vicki Seliger-Swenson, whose sister was murdered in front of her four children in 2006. Her family's story illustrates the ripple effects domestic violence has not only on the victim, but their family and friends, their community, and the quality of life that we all enjoy in Minnesota. I'm sad to report that at the beginning of this legislative session, we released our 2007 report. And in that report, we detailed that at least 22 women, 10 children, and 3 men lost their lives as a result of domestic violence. In addition, according to the Office of Justice Programs within the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, over 50,000 women, men, and children receive services from Minnesota's battered women's shelters and community-based domestic abuse programs. So far, in 2008, 3 women, 3 children, and 1 man have lost their lives as a result of domestic violence, and it's only the second week in March. We have a long way to go before we end domestic violence in our state, and the funding increase that you provided was a step in the prevention direction. The proposed 2% budget cut would wipe out the funding increase you provided, and combined with the increase in demand that programs are seeing and their increased operation costs, would have a dramatic impact on their ability to provide services. Public safety is one of the fundamental roles of government, so we ask that you continue your support of victims in the state by maintaining this vital funding increase, and we thank you for your hard work ahead.
Thank you, Ms. Bellucci. Questions? Okay, next.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Donna Dunn. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you and briefly address our concerns about funding levels for sexual assault advocacy programs in Minnesota. We are very aware of the looming budget challenge that you all are facing and of the governor's proposed cut to crime victim service programs, which include advocacy and support services for sexual assault survivors. I'm here to let you know just how critical it is to maintain the current funding level for the safety of our communities and for the health and well-being of sexual assault victim survivors in Minnesota. The Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault is a statewide voice for victims, survivors, for sexual assault programs, and for those allies in our midst who are committed to ending sexual violence. We provide training, technical assistance, networking, and support to over 70 programs that are coordinating an entire range of 24-hour-a-day services in all but 13 of Minnesota's counties. There are 13 counties that have no sexual assault services. The programs under the MnCASA umbrella also work tirelessly to counteract the messages which support this commonly occurring but uncommonly hidden crime. We know that sexual violence is the most underreported crime of violence in our communities. It happens in private. It happens in secrecy between people known to one another. And the very secrecy and victim blaming and shame that survivors experience keeps them from trusting that helping services and communities will indeed help. Advocacy programs exist to counterbalance that trend. Programs are there to help victim survivors know what options are open to them, to help traditional systems such as the criminal justice system, healthcare system, the mental health system, school systems, understand what helping role they can take to ensure that victim survivors find the safety and the support they need in the aftermath of assault. Ultimately, our goal is to create safety for victims, accountability for offenders, and justice in our communities. And this is not just an intellectual or an idle issue. Minnesota research indicates that 1 in 4 Minnesota girls and 1 in 7 Minnesota boys are victims of sexual violence. Last year, the Minnesota Department of Health issued a report, The Costs of Sexual Violence in Minnesota, in which they cited that in 2005, the issue of sexual violence cost Minnesota over $8 billion. We say over $8 billion because we know that the data that was used for that report didn't include city, county, or tribal costs. So those costs related to local incarceration, to local investigation, prosecution, and probation were not included, or medical care costs were not included in this $8 billion figure. The report also cites that in 2005, 61,000 Minnesotans were sexually assaulted. Now, this is enough to fill the Metrodome for a home game, but we, of course, are not talking about a game. The base level of funding for sexual assault advocacy programs is just over $43,000 per county, including the increase that you granted last year. With this funding, programs are mandated by the funder to provide crisis service 24 hours a day, to provide general services that link victim survivors with programs and services that they need, such as assistance with transportation, information and referral, assistance during law enforcement investigations, during medical examinations, during court activities, in filing compensation claims, in filing restraining orders, in accessing human, social, and family services, assistance with interpretation, translation, and culturally appropriate materials. And if we're not yet all tired, they also provide support groups. Additionally, programs are required to assure that staff, including volunteers, are competently trained and supervised, that the community is educated and that awareness is raised, that professionals are trained and systems are changed to better meet the needs of victims, and that programs partner in communities to ensure seamless services across the variety of programs functioning in a community. That's a lot of service for $43,000. We don't argue with these standards. We know that they are all critical elements of an effective community program. We also recognize how unrealistic it is to do these really critical services with current resources. Thanks to you again, and I will repeat what Ms. Ferrucci said, the increase in base funding, which was granted last year, was a wonderful result. In fact, as she said, in 2007 marked the first positive adjustment in state funding since 1996 to support the increased demand for services. I want you to know that this increase is an important piece in the puzzle of providing community services to sexual assault victims. Our programs tell us they are increasingly facing new and emerging trends. And I will let Ms. Martin talk about Rochester, but she shared some stories with me that that indicate that this ability to respond to emerging trends is really critical for our programs. Our program in St. Cloud indicated to us that the number of cases reported to them, reported to law enforcement, and to the hospital has risen dramatically. The advocates are spread thin responding. We also note that in Ramsey and Hennepin counties, we have three programs attempting to serve a population of millions across a large geographic area. All of our partner programs are experiencing pressures and changes in their communities. The increase awarded last year has enhanced their ability to respond to these increasing demands. I know that it's not lost on you that it is primarily through victim advocacy programs and victims accessing those programs that we are able in our communities to identify who the sex offenders are in our midst. This is a critical public safety issue. Well, the needs of programs and of victims are real. We are not trying to guard against a potential threat. This is a real threat in Minnesota communities. The costs report from the Health Department outlines in dollars the personal and community devastation that accompanies sexual violence. The network of programs across the state is working to intervene in the cycle and to offer hope and resources for victims. They do so on a very thin dime. This is the very time it is critical to keep the funding intact, to ensure that our commitment to safety and to accountability and justice comes closer to keeping pace with the rising demand for help. Thank you. I hope you will keep these comments in mind as you look at your budget considerations.
Thank you, Ms. Dunn. Senator Ingebrigtsen, I'm going to turn the gavel over to you because I have to go present some bills. I know you had a question. There you go. Wish me luck.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good luck. Question I have, and first of all, I want to thank the three of you for what you do. It's no secret I worked with advocacy groups over my years as deputies and being a deputy and sheriff. And I've seen the accomplishments over the years from where we used to be back in the early days to now. My question to you is a couple questions, actually. How much have the counties given in the past, and are they giving now? And have they ever given her? Is that kind of a county-by-county basis on an average?
Mr. Chair and members of the community, that is actually a county determination. There are some programs, and I know Ms. Martin works in a county that does contribute, but that is really a county-by-county determination.
Another question. So those counties are requested of dollars every year? Or do you go to the counties to request for dollars besides coming to the state?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that would be a decision that the individual program would choose to make. I know that the amount of funding that comes from the state is not sufficient, and some programs are better able to access other public funding or other foundation support, and they do work on that.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Foley,
when you're getting funded, that you in fact do get individual funding, so that big share of the money that you get is from private sources and not the public, what I'm able to determine. Is that correct?
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Senator Foley, yeah, our programs are combining their state funding with local private donations, individual donations, and foundation grants. But as you know, and I'm sure you've heard from other human service providers, those funds have also been limited, as well as cuts to local government aid have also affected programs' ability to go to their counties. So it's a cumulative effect that I'm sure you've heard with other service providers that our programs are facing as well.
Okay. Anything else from the committee? Next presenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jean Martin. I'm a program director for Victim Services for Dodge, Fillmore, and Olmsted County. And I was here today as a part of the Rochester contingent for Rochester on Tour. So I thank Senator Higgins for the recognition and the invitation to testify, even though I didn't come prepared today to testify. I'm pleased to speak to this issue. I supervise a group of advocates that work directly with crime victims, and we serve crime victims, the general crime victim that does not include sexual assault and or battered women, as well as the sexual assault victim. And a companion program in our county serves the battered women in our county. I have four advocates that work out of our Olmsted County office and one advocate in each of our Dodge and our Fillmore County office. And they work with approximately 1,300 victims, all of the crime victims for our counties each year. Some of the stresses that we found advocates are under are kind of the ripple effect, I would suggest, from stresses in other parts of our system. So when we have overburdened courts, and in our county, our district court is closing now for service one morning a week because of the budget cuts, we see some of that ripple effect in our offices, where crime victims that come to file are file orders for protection, perhaps, are coming down to our office because that window is closed. We're only into the second week of that, so we really don't know what the ripple effect of that might be. But we do find that it is advocates who must safeguard the crime victims' rights that came into effect in the mid-'80s. And if advocates are not there to safeguard those rights, in these times of stress and pressure on the rest of the system, we find that those can all too often fall by the wayside. And victims might not know about plea agreements if an advocate isn't there representing their interests in court. Those are some of the effects and the fears that I might have for the impact on our system if crime victim services is not funded adequately. So I do appreciate the opportunity to speak to that.
Any questions for the witness? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We come to the point in the agenda to ask, are there any other testifiers that wish to testify with regards to the governor's proposal? Go ahead. Please identify yourself. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I'm Joan Fabian. I'm the Commissioner of Corrections.
Welcome.
I just wanted to say all of these cuts are hard, and I know even the short-term offenders, I spent a lot of time last year trying to get money for the short-term offenders, so it's real difficult. And I also know that you're going to be hearing a lot of testimony in different times about the need to reinstate things that are possibly cut. The governor did minimize the cuts to corrections, and he did it for, I think, some really good reasons, and mainly that the Department of Corrections does provide core public safety services, and I don't need to go into what those are. The other reason that he minimized our cuts was because in making his recommendation, he looked at the fact that the Department of Corrections has experienced staggering growth in both field and prison operations, but and at the time, we have also made a lot of cuts. I don't know in the past, before I came, if we had fat in the budget, but I'm here to tell you now we absolutely have no fat. We have cut over $80 million in the bienniums in the past decade and have eliminated over 300 positions, 200 of those in the prisons for per diem reduction. We have double bunked in our high risk or our high security prisons, and we have done everything to take like functions that are in all the different prisons. We have consolidated those and saved about 100 positions that way when we did the budget cuts. We really believe, and I'm honestly telling you, that further reductions will severely compromise public safety and the safety of our staffs. You guys look in the newspaper every day and see the child molesters and the baby killers and the rapists that are coming to prison. And while they are temporarily out of the community, which they should be, and should be in prison where they are, our staff there is dealing with them every single day and putting themselves at risk. We have a huge increase in what's going on with gang activity in our prisons. Just 2 weeks ago, we did a search of all this whole complex and found numerous weapons that were, we had gotten information that there was going to be a gang fight. So we found many, many weapons, and these are the kinds of things that our people are putting up with every single day. They're paid to do it, but we all, I do and you have, a responsibility to make sure that we keep them safe and not cut anymore. We just can't take any more cuts. And the other thing that has happened is because of cuts and because even last year when we came and talked about our needs, we weren't fully funded in a number of areas. In fact, the conference committee came back and reconvened to and put $5 million back in for our costs, and we need salary costs. We didn't get the full amount that we needed. This year, we're looking at a $10 million deficit, and we showed that to the governor. That's another reason why we're looking to absorb those costs. And I don't know how we can possibly cut any more in the budget. So I just felt I needed to say that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee? Senator Foley?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, one of the things you talked about was double bunking, and how is that going from a safety standpoint, especially with the staff?
Mr. Chair, Senator Foley, we would really prefer not double bunking. It's much more difficult for the staff, but we're doing the best we can with it. And that was the unit where we found all the weapons.
Question I have, Commissioner, is are you looking at more double bunking? Is it at all feasible? Now, I know, I understand what staffing is about when you're talking about doubling them up, and I understand very, very clearly what issues they go through when they're dealing with these people that we expect as taxpayers to have locked up for doing the wrong things. And is there anything on the horizon at all, or do you not just simply have that room?
Mr. Chair, we absolutely are not looking at more double bunking. We have in all of our medium facilities, it's like 85% already double bunked. Where the change had been made was that we were double bunking at, we never were double bunking at the Stillwaters in St. Cloud. And that's, you know, where we did double bunk. And it's not a really good idea.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anybody else would like to testify before we move on? We would like to thank everybody for coming to testify with regards to the budget. Next on the agenda is Senator Gimsey as a statewide public safety radio financing technical correction. And with you today, you have a witness.
Yes, I do. Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to present to you House File 3000. Now, what this is a technical bill that changes the approval point, if you will, for counties that want to seek bonding for infrastructure and equipment for the statewide or the armor system. The Public Safety Radio System Planning Committee was eliminated in 2001, and most of those duties were rolled over into the statewide radio board, and all we're doing here is simply changing the approval process to the statewide radio board from the dissolved Safety Radio System Planning Committee. And we have Scott Wiggins here, who is the director of the Division of Emergency Communications Networks, if there are any questions on the part of the committee.
Mr. Director, would you identify yourself, or do you have any comments?
Mr. Chair and members, thanks very much. Scott Wiggins, the director of Emergency Communication Networks at the Department of Public Safety. The department has brought this bill forward today at the request of the Statewide Radio Board. It is, as Senator Gimsey has indicated, a technical bill. The Planning Committee no longer exists. The function were rolled into the Statewide Radio Board, so it is truly a technical name change.
Any questions from the committee? Senator Gimsey, you wish to move the bill? If so, it moves to full Finance Committee. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman?
Oh, would somebody in the committee move the bill?
Move it for him. I don't understand what it's doing here. It doesn't seem to be a financial issue, so.
I think it's a technical thing. I'm not sure exactly at all.
Those are usually handled in the policy committee.
Maybe Chris could enlighten us as to why it's on the committee, why it's on the agenda. I don't know that.
Mr. Chairman, members,
it
has.
Why is it referred to this committee or finance at all?
I agree with Senator Berglund. It has no financial implications. It's just correcting an obsolete reference.
Okay, so, but it still does, I understand, need to go from here to the full Finance Committee then?
Yes.
Yeah. Senator Berglund, would you move that bill?
Yeah, I did.
You did. Senator Berglund moves that.
Mr. Full Finance.
Senator?
Mr. Chairman, thanks. I guess I didn't realize that it had to go to the full Finance Committee. I didn't know it had another stop scheduled. Have they requested that?
We are a creature of them.
Oh, I see.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
Senator, so Senator Higgins moved. All those in favor? I'm sorry. Senator, what did I say? Senator Berglund, I'm sorry. Moves the bill to the full Finance Committee. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee.
Members, just some announcements here. The Judiciary Committee will meet 15 minutes after we adjourn in room 15, as well as another couple other announcements here. 10 o'clock in Monday at the BCA headquarters. We're going to be looking at the an overview of the burn grant cuts and all federal funding for Department of Corrections and Department of Public Safety.
What was the first announcement?
I'm sorry?
What was the first announcement?
The first one for the Judiciary Committee?
Oh, okay.
We'll meet in 15 minutes after we adjourn here in room 15. Okay? If there's nothing else, we're adjourned.